This is...
Wow! What a week.
What a week. Polytrix.
Welcome. This is hashtag Polytrix with Botsang Muilwa. So, our political commentator likes a good joll now and then. And we're pretty sure that if he had to launch a party, there'd be more than a few dozen people who'd show up. For now, though, we're glad to have him as our get-together. Welcome back to Politrix with Botsang Muilwa. Botsang is in the building. Botsang!
Yes, Tato, good morning and morning to the subscribers and followers.
Welcome to Discover TV. They are our home for this episode.
Yes, different feeling, different view, but I like it.
And TVs that remind you of your childhood.
Hey, man, the black and white one that I used to slap when the battery is low and it will have a line in the middle. Yeah. Then you shake the battery and hit the TV for it to function again.
I remember friends of mine had a black and white TV.
Yes.
They had a TV before we bought a TV.
Yes.
So we'd go watch TV at their house. And there used to be a VW ad, red, yellow, blue. Good for me and you. Doobie, doobie, doo. For the longest time, I didn't like those cars because on TV, I couldn't see the colors.
Oh, because of black and white. Imaginary colors.
Anyway, welcome, brother.
Thanks, brother Fresh.
Let's start in the courts. The EFF were in court. And what happened?
Well, unfortunately, you remember we spoke about it about 2 weeks ago. They filed late and the court said they are muddying the case and they arrived late to filing and they appealed for the decision of the court. But unfortunately, the court threw it out. And unfortunately for the EFF, they didn't accept their appeal.
Sure.
So the ruling or the decision of the parliament regarding the banning of the EFF stands as it is. And unfortunately, they were not going to be part of the sauna. But, you know, the ruling, it's not only about them and their salaries docked for February and as well as being absent for the sauna. But the parliament went further to, you know, amend the parliamentary rules and say they also want to, not necessarily towards the EFF.
In fact, I love how they said this is not aimed at any particular party, but every new rule is aimed at things they have done.
That they have done. And anyway, when Parliament passes a rule, and this is the problem when we are sitting with, you know, pensioners who are neo-colonized. And if you say you want decorum and decent dressing in Parliament, what are they talking about?
And what's the standard?
Or what is the standard?
Is it a colonial standard?
Or a tie? Exactly.
Is it a colonial standard? Is it an Afro chic standard?
I have said before, the founding president of democracy, Nelson Mandela, went and addressed Parliament and the United Nations and various international bodies and platforms and forums wearing what used to be known as Madiba shirt.
Yes.
And is it not a decorum? So are you going to start saying, coming to Parliament with T-girl clothes and workers' clothes, as EFF calls them, and overalls and makarapa, is it not decorum? When EFF did that, they are not saying it's EFF, but when they said that, they said it is in representing of the masses and the unemployed and the youth and the, you know, blue-collar workers. But, you know, way back in 2013, when I was politically active, my father's cousin, Uhuru Muilwa, was the ANC deputy speaker in Gauteng. He became an MEC after.
Yes.
And we once had a debate on Power FM, Power Perspective. Mm. And I was supposed to go in the parliamentary list of the party I belonged to. And I said to him, Uhuru, you watch me. Should we go to a son? I'll come there wearing tsikha and let somebody try and stop me.
A loincloth.
A loincloth. Yes. And let somebody stop me from walking into parliament with my loincloth. And who said, as long as your bum will be shined, there's enough Vaseline, he can come with it. So it's going to be a very tough one for parliament. I listened to the Secretary of Parliament trying to explain what do they mean, but it's a wait and see situation. And certainly for the Red Berets, that all six of their leaders will not be in parliament.
They weren't in parliament.
Yeah, so you know, it's it's an unfortunate issue. But we'll see in front. Another thing with this decision vis-a-vis the sauna is this decision to say they are now banning or stopping parliamentarians to can stop and question the head of state as and when he's presenting the speech, and they should wait for next week when it's time to return. So I was sitting and thinking, if they are going to spend 6.5 million for the sauna as they've done, and the previous year it was 5 million, just increased to 6.5 million, contrary to what the new don't promise the people. Say they'll cut budget, they'll cut spending, they'll cut this. They've increased it to 6.5 million now. 6.5 million, and you see there, you listen to President Ramaphosa. How was it not possible for President Ramaphosa not to give that speech in public television and platform? Because they will respond next week.
Another family meeting.
What is the purpose of all those people going there in glitz and glamour with their beautiful spouses, nice clothes? I think they are bored. They don't have entertainment. And they go and they blew 6.5 million for listening to the president. You can't question the president. You can't challenge. You can't heckle and all those things. So you just sit there and listen like a principal talking. And then you go and have nice dinners and you go home. You could have said that statement on national television and issued to political parties to prepare for the questions that are coming in the week we are heading to. So for me, wasteful state resources and again, same old story. Nothing new, nothing different.
You know what kind of sauna I'm looking forward to one day? And hopefully it will happen in our time. I'm looking forward to a sauna where Mr. President comes to you, us, and says, this is what I promised last year. This box has been ticked. This box has been ticked. Okay, we're a bit slow here. Don't worry. I promised you that your ministers will be under my hawk eye. This minister hasn't delivered, will not be joining us anymore. Minister Muilo, you're fired. I'm looking forward to a sauna that is actually accountable statistically, and so that it's not just a talk shop.
This is just a speech listening to one person actually. Yes. But also, one thing that political office bearers don't understand is that failing to deliver is not an absolute failure.
Sure.
You can own up to say, I had promised ABC, I delivered A and B, I failed on C, I couldn't deliver C. But don't stop there. You should be able to say, here are the corrective measures that I've put into place to correct the undoing of the C and do it better next time. There's nothing wrong with that. We are human beings. We don't have to achieve 100% or 90% at all times. But take responsibility, be accountable, and give solutions to move forward. Don't wait for election year then to give us solutions in moving forward. No, they should do it as and when we move. That's why I was worried that why doesn't politicians have monitoring processes like us as public servants or employees of government? You know, you've got quarterly reports, you've got midterm reviews and all that. Those measures were put into place in order to monitor where you are leaking, where you are delaying, and to put corrective measures in place timeously.
Sure.
But I don't think, you know, ministers and all that go through that process. And I think if they can start implementing monitoring processes, not just to report at the end of the term, and then you keep quiet about your failures and you fail to own up to that. And I think it will help the system a lot.
What's happening with the Competition Commission, the banks that allegedly colluded to fix the rand or the trading of the rand? Where are we in that regard? Because I'm told it was thrown out.
Yeah, no, look, what happened was the Competition Commission is taking the matter to the Constitutional Court.
Okay.
One, you remember we were once concerned about why is this matter being handled solely by the Competition Commission? There's no support from Financial Intelligence Center. There's no support from the banking sector, the former FSB. There's no support from South African Revenue Services because there's an exchange rate element on that. And the South African Reserve Bank, you know, as being the central bank of the country. Now, the Competition Commission is seen to running solely or alone with this without the support of other public or Chapter 9 institutions. I'm of the opinion that, for example, the Public Protector's Office was supposed to support or be a partner with the Competition Commission in dealing with this rent manipulation saga or story, because members of the public, me and you as ordinary citizens, were affected by the manipulation of the currency against the dollar. But what has happened now is that the Competition Commission is taking the matter to the Constitutional Court after the Competition Commission Appeal Court, because they've got their own appeal court, said, one, they don't have jurisdiction to can prosecute foreign banks. Remember, there are 13, you know, international banks that are involved in this. There's four South African banks, or in total, eight banks that have reached, you know, consensus with them. They've admitted for doing that, and they will find penalties, which is a slap in the hand. But 13 others are refusing to cooperate, and the a competition appeal tribunal has given them a little bit of a leeway at the moment. And I think I would support the competition commission to take this matter up to the constitutional court. There's a lot of parties not political in this instance. I've not even seen one political party question, except, no, let me correct myself, except the ATM. They've come up and issued a formal statement in support of the Competition Commission and to say these banks must respond. All other political parties, especially the three major parties, the ANC, the EFF, and the DA, they haven't said anything much regarding the manipulation of the currency. But I think, if you recall, in November last year, I wrote to all 400 MPs, and they went silent, not even acknowledgement. And as individuals, and I think I'm going to support the Competition Commission and call on also the Public Protector's Office, because I had copied them that memo to say we cannot sit and fold our arms as a nation and let the Competition Commission alone to can fight this battle against the manipulation of a national currency. And quite surprisingly, the Reserve Bank is silent about it as well. But let's hope that once this matter reaches the Constitutional Court, those constitutional judges will apply their minds properly to say that there's acceptance, right? It's no longer an allegation, because other banks have agreed and conceded to the fact that the rent was manipulated by them. Now, the issue is no longer whether they did it or not. So it's no longer an allegation. The issue is the Competition Commission empowered to can prosecute them or to can charge them? And that's where we are. And that's why I'm saying the call should now be focused on other Chapter 9 institutions and those regulators who are supposed to regulate the banks and be watchdogs of the national currency to say, let's support our sister agency to can push this case forward. And that's where we are as a nation.
And I thought the banks that were named and given a slap on the wrist because they turned witness.
Yes. Against the other ones. Yes.
Exactly. That's what I thought.
Yeah, no. It's the position. That is the but as I've said earlier, the bone of contention is 13 of these banks, 20 something of them, are foreign banks.
Sure.
So the question is the Competition Commission has jurisdiction to can prosecute those banks outside the borders of South Africa.
Sure.
And for me, I doubt if they have that jurisdiction, but if they're still operating in South Africa and they connived with South African banks, why don't we prosecute them and charge them within the bounds of South Africa? Look, it was not only South Africa that was involved in this. The US was involved. Germany was involved. We have cases now in Germany where those banks paid, billions of euros to the German government as penalties. So why wouldn't we apply the same rule? The problem is, in Germany, it was pushed on by the central bank. You understand? And we are using the Competition Commission. So the Competition Commission naturally is to check if there's fair competition between organizations inside South Africa. In this instance, there was conniving between South African banks and foreign banks. And I think that's where the challenge is. There's a gray area of the jurisdiction of the Competition Commission.
Because there's also the question of, at a practical level, how could have they colluded? I mean, are they in a WhatsApp group? Was there a meeting in a dark room?
Look.
Because anything that they could have done to collude and to meet would have left a trail.
Yeah.
Would have left evidence.
I think there's a trail. That's why there's confessions. I think there's a trail. There's evidence. I've said I knew about this since 2002, but on court papers, they're saying between 2007 until 2014. This happened from 2002. There is evidence. And that's why others, considered and said, look, this happened. But what more evidence do we need as a nation when we know what happened to the rand at that time to move from the rate of 7.90 to the dollar? In one day we woke up, it was 11 rands to $1. And I don't think it's an issue of there's no material evidence or records of their engagement. It is, I don't think that that's the issue. I think the problem is the state entity, which is not a bulldog biting entity, is being put at the forefront to can fight this, huge, economic animals. That it's going to be a very tough one, for the Competition Commission that is failing to deal with minor issues in the country, to be dealing with multinational banks. And that's why my call is, let other state institutions, the South African Reserve Bank, the Public Protector, the South African Revenue Services, the Financial Services Board, which is now called Financial Sector, Banking Sector, something. Let those people come in in support of this case, it will have much more power if we do it that way as a nation.
Absolutely. The last case in the courts, Mr. Makate versus Vodacom.
Yes.
Mr. Makate was a Vodacom employee. He suggested a paging idea for if you want to have someone call you. It's called Please Call Me.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if Botsang doesn't have enough airtime, you can page me on my phone and say, please call me. And obviously, Vodacom generated income and tons of it from the Please Call Me service. Mr. Makate eventually won in court that since it was his idea and it was proven as such, he must be compensated and compensated fairly. But the courts obviously stopped short of saying how much the compensation should be. Then they were told they must go discuss it. I think Vodacom offered him 46 million or something.
Yes, 40 million, yes.
And he said, no, I need a percentage of whatever this idea of mine has generated.
Yeah.
And obviously he held the fort down and said, I will wait, basically. And now the Supreme Court of Appeals have said Vodacom need to come up with a better offer.
Mm-hmm.
And people calculating how much Please Call Me has made figure a couple billion are due to Mr. Makate.
Well, Fresh, thumbs up to Mpo Makate.
Yes, for hanging in there.
It's a Goliath, David versus Goliath this time, not Goliath versus David, because he has always been a step ahead of them. But also thumbs up to the Supreme Court of Appeal.
Mm.
Because they've done what we complained about before. The decision of the High Court previously to say he invented the call, Please Call Me, and he has to be compensated for that. And they stopped there. So they allowed the two parties, Vodacom and Mr. Makate, to go and you know, reach a consensus and a settlement of how much is he owed. I think it was to his disadvantage, because obviously Vodacom will offer. They make 4 billion, they offer you a 40 million, which is simple as 0.1% of what they made. But when he rejected 40 million, majority of doomsayers were saying, this guy doesn't even have 2 million in his account. I will just take it and accept it. And I'm one of the people who said, you should not. It's a matter of principle.
Absolutely.
There is a principle, and the law is on his side to this advantage. But what the Supreme Court of Appeal has done now, they've put a figure to it to say he must be compensated between 5% and 7.5%. So they must go and agree of what they made, which is amounting to billions of rands. At least there's a figure. The second thing that is very important, which the Supreme Court of Appeal has done, and I wish most of our courts could do that in various cases, they've put a time frame to it to say within 30 days, Vodacom must go and do the calculation and come with an offer. If he accepts it, they will sign an agreement. If they don't, but anyway, at the moment, what has happened is Vodacom has decided to take the matter to the Constitutional Court, which is the last step they can take it up to. But I think, look, the man must not give up at the moment. It's a battle. It's not only an economic battle. It's also a political battle. Because if this invention, in my view, and looking at the history of this country, was done by somebody coming from the United States or a white person who could be talking a different story, they are taking advantage of him. But he waited for almost 20 years. It's been 20 years. So giving up when you are left with 2 months, I would not do that. I think you should fight this battle. But and as soon as you know, Paul, I've been one of his people rooting for him. As soon as he gets a tweet, I'm going to send him a please call me.
Please call, I need foul.
I will not put a figure. I will not put a figure to it. But this is one fighter that has showed us that if you believe you are correct, if you've got an innovation or invention, you must stick to your guns and fight a battle. You know, a lot of black people in South Africa, Fresh, have lost. I remember the Moyo case with Olmushwale, because people, my own case with the government, because people give up along the lines. You get tired, you get drained.
And often they tie you up in the courts. No one's going to drain your legal resources.
Your resources, yes. You understand?
Not because they need to do it.
Yes, and they are using public resources. Sure. But with Vodacom, it's a private business. They are multi-billion rand business. I checked, you know, before I came to the studio, if any of the Vodacom shares were impacted by the Supreme Court of Appeal decision during the week. Nothing much. There's not much that happened there. So you can see that it's a very stable business. It's a very stable, you know, organization. But I think Vodacom must stop playing dirty. You know, it's about time. That guy is not going to give up. But also what they don't realize is the court even included interest. in this matter. So they're going to lose more. The more they waste time. I don't think the Constitutional Court will come with any different decision in this matter. People think the courts will look at this an individual who is not worth the billions. They are forgetting that battle, whether he invented this and he's got a kid, it's done. At the moment, it's how much is he entitled to. And that's where the battle is. But I think Mpho must stick to his guns, and Mr. Makate must actually fight Goliath until Goliath collapses. And I think that's what we should do. But the court have been very fair. In this instance, thumbs up to the Supreme Court of Appeal for giving the date, as I've said, as well as at least a percentage. They should actually fix the percentage. What is between 5 and 7.5 of what they've made? Why couldn't they say 5 or 6? Why do you still leave a room? A Vodacom will say, we'll give you 5. And he will stand up and say, no, I need 7. You see, there's still a room to play. They should have even tightened it more. And I think if our courts are going to start ruling in that fashion or that manner, a lot of cases will not waste time in court. If the High Court would have put the figure in the time, at that time, would have not wasted time at the Supreme Court of Appeal. Now they're going to the Constitutional Court. But what I like about Constitutional Court cases in South Africa, they don't take too long. It's a very quick, you know, there's not many cases there. So they will hear the case will be finished in the next few months.
Because that's the thing that surprised me a lot, that, you know, you'd have thought that the courts would have arrived at a figure, as opposed to leave it out there to them.
To them, yeah. And I think that's the unfair part. You know, that's the unfair part. Come up with a figure or tell the parties when they come to court to come with a calculation. Let me make an example with the Labour Court. When I went to the CCMA with my court, there was a figure, the commissioner or the presiding officer said, how much is your salary per month? This is how much your employer should pay you. The figure is there, understand? So it's easier and better that way, especially when you don't have the resources. But when you have people wasting state resources or company resources, Vodacom paying lawyers to save billions, it means nothing for them.
Sure.
Understand? So even the money that he will get at the end of the case, imagine how much the lawyers that are representing him are going to get. Normally, when you sign these concessions with legal teams to represent you, it's not pro bono. You get into an agreement, then you'll pay if you win or at the end. They will take something between 20 and 25%. Sometimes it goes to 30% of your income. But it was a fight with it.
Absolutely. Speaking of fights, what's happening at the ICJ?
Oh, the International Court of Justice. Yeah, we you know, South Africans are not fair people. After our in inverted commas victory at the ICJ, we came home, celebrated, and Palestine is still being bombed. But that's not what we are talking about today. In the past week, the ICJ had a sitting again to look at the application of NATO countries supporting Ukraine. Ukraine took a matter there. If you recall, it was mainly based on women and children that Russia had taken from, that primarily, that's the first part, from Ukraine into Russia. But there was a court order that the Russians should return those and release those people to back to Ukraine, to their motherland, which Russia did. But the application was, is it genocide what Russia is doing to Ukraine? Because obviously when there's a war, there'll be casualties, women and children, and you know, hospitals will be bombed and all that. So what is happening is people were saying, why is South Africa not supporting Ukraine the same way as the way we were supporting Palestine in this International Court of Justice regarding the war between NATO and Russia over Ukraine? But Russia came out victorious in this case because the ICJ ruled that this is not genocide. And those individuals or ordinary citizens who perished during this, you know, it's 2 years now, this three-year-old war. It was casualties of war. It's not to say Russia targeted them specifically.
Sure.
You also have civilians and children and women in Russia who died because of this. So Russia became out victorious in this instance. And the you know, rockets and bombs are still flying between these two countries. I think this is where the diplomatic, you know, community should now come in and go back to the drawing board and say to Russia and Ukraine, can you go back to the, you know, to the table? Because also, what is also very important on this ruling of the ICJ in favor of Russia, The ICJ has quoted what the agreement that was signed in 2014 between the two countries and said, but Ukraine went against an agreement, and so Russia is reacting. And that was an international agreement sanctioned by the United Nations. So you go to the United Nations and say, I broke the agreement and this guy started bombing me or taking me or occupying my land. The question is, why did you break the agreement? And I think that agreement, having it being on paper and endorsed by the United Nations, it went to the advantage of Russia at the moment. So when people have been asking me, why is South Africa taking sides with Russia, which is an aggressor in this instance? And I've been saying the merits of the case of Russia and Ukraine and Palestine and Israel are not the same. This is not the same case scenario. It's not the same situation.
Apples and bananas.
Yes.
Absolutely. Let's go to the coup belt. Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso on some ECOWAS peace out.
Yeah.
There was a meeting, I think, in Abuja, Nigeria having a baby about it. Now there's another meeting because obviously those three countries from the coup belt leaving ECOWAS could destabilize ECOWAS.
Very, very much so, Fresh. One, it's not only the meeting with Nigeria, Ghana also has been shaking on this. What is important about this whole thing to note is that the, you like calling the coup belt, the three rascal countries with military governments, they were like with immediate effect. And obviously it will destabilize trade and, you know, trade facilitation in ECOWAS. For our viewers who do not know, ECOWAS is the counterpart of SADC. We are in the southern part of Africa. It's the economic community of West Africa. Now, they have decided to withdraw. And countries like Ghana and Nigeria are against that. They actually had, you know, as we are sitting here, an agent, you know, their security council meeting to look at that. Countries like Nigeria and Ghana, in my view, they are not fair towards these former French colonies. And I'll explain to you why. They are worried about instability and security within the region. They never cared about the economic situation of these three countries, which is Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. They never cared about them.
At the hands of France.
At the hand of France. You know, Fresh, the central banks or the reserve banks of these countries, actually, the treasury, they report to the French Central Bank. So they're literally a branch of the French Central Bank, and they're trading, they've been trading in the French franc until this coup. But they have decided they are leaving ECOWAS because their surrounding countries, their partners who are supposed to be supporting them, are not doing that. Procedurally and diplomatically, in terms of the conventions, they have to give a one-year notice. But those are military guys. No, they don't care about 1 year notice. They said, we are leaving immediately. Do whatever you want to do. And that's why Ghana and Nigeria and other member states of ECOWAS are jumping around. But also, how will it impact the economy in that region? This is the difficulty that they will suffer. But this is what happens when you are in a battle. There will always be casualties. These three countries are all landlocked. They are landlocked countries, and they are dependent on a country like Nigeria and Ghana, which have the sea. So it's the same situation as Botswana and Zambia and Zimbabwe. They are landlocked, and they are dependent on Mozambique, South Africa, and Namibia, and Angola to some extent. So in order to do a movement of people and goods between those three countries and their neighbors, they will still need to trade with them. And with the Africa, you know, open trade happening at the moment, it's going to heavily impact on the trade and movement of passengers and goods between those two countries. As an example, during the AFCON, what happened was during the African Cup of Nations, the soccer tournament, some of citizens or residents of those three countries had traveled with ECOWAS passports to Ivory Coast. And they were afraid that when their countries have now withdrawn, when they are sitting in Ivory Coast, will they be able to travel back home with ECOWAS passports? Because unlike us in SADC, they've got an ECOWAS, a regional passport. So member states of those countries, they carry one passport. Whether you are from Burkina Faso or Mali, you all have the same passport. The East African community is also doing, you know, the same thing, coming with one passport. But it has been clear that the people will be allowed to move, but the problem is going to be goods. Because Nigeria and Ghana have started imposing sanctions on these three countries for security reasons, which I think is very much unfair. When you look at our colonial masters, France, Ghana and Nigeria, they are members of the Commonwealth. They were colonized by the British, okay? They are English-speaking countries. The British is not treating them They are not neo-colonized anymore. It's not treating them and controlling them and owning their resources the way France is doing with its former colonies.
In fact, they're treating them like they're still colonies.
You understand? They're treating them as still colonies.
In the bigger scheme of things, they are still colonies.
Exactly. All their resources are controlled by France. Their national council is controlled by France. France decided until the coup who will be the head of state, who will be in government. Now, their neighbors...
Isn't that ironic, though? Because Abuja or Nigeria is saying... You guys are going to destabilize us as ECOWAS because you're allowing foreign interests to dictate to you the next course of action.
Yeah. While they wanted them to is France not a foreign?
Hence I'm saying, surely the irony there is clear.
But I think the heads of states and military leaders of this country have decided to ignore Nigeria and Ghana because they've been pushing. Nigeria itself has internal problems with insurgents, with people are taking their police in police barracks and their soldiers, and they are talking about instability when they're unstable inside the country with military skirmishes and things like that. But I also think if you look at economic reports, Burkina Faso and Niger, in the last 6 months, they've been the fastest growing economies, not only in Africa, in the world, after reclaiming their mining and natural resources. They will suffer for quite some time. There will be casualties, economic casualties. But they've been poor countries anyway with rich natural resources that were benefiting France. And I think they've taken a standpoint to the regional body, ECOWAS, and say, if you want us to continue to be members, you have to stand with us, one as brothers, two as neighbors, and three against the aggressor, which is France. It may not be a military aggression that France was doing there. It was an absolute economic sabotage and exploitation. And these countries have stood up and said, but this man, this old colonizer, we are still feeling like colonized, and we want that to stop. And I'm very disappointed with countries like Nigeria and Ghana, which are now going to abuse their ports and in their access to the seaports, and that will actually strain and damage the economy of these three countries. But look, countries like Russia and China, you don't rely on a sea and rail or road transport only in order to can run your economy. We'll have countries like China and Russia stepping in and say, we'll fly goods in there, whether with military choppers or what, but we'll fly goods in there, you understand? So trying to squeeze them to say you will frustrate the road corridors or the rail corridors, if rail corridors exist there. And instead of aiding them, look at what Namibia has done with Namport. And I spoke about this before. In Namibia, they have given land to Botswana and Zambia. So Botswana and Zambia, they are landlocked countries, but they've got port facilities in Namport, especially the port of Walvis Bay. And that's what neighbors do. That's what countries that are trading economically should be doing. Instead of squeezing them economically and punishing them and saying, you don't have a sea, therefore you are not going to benefit.
Create a corridor. Let's be neighborly.
Exactly. And this is what Ghana and Nigeria and other countries around there, which have access to the sea, is supposed to be doing in supporting Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. But they are not doing that. They are instead crying with France on the same side. And you ask yourself, if they were even former French colonies, would understand to say France is squeezing them on the side. You understand? But they were also not even French colonies. You know, and they are free in inverted commas, because I still believe that nobody's free in Africa. And then they are free from the control of the UK or of England. And yet they don't want Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger to be free from the control of France. And I want to see how the AU, this is what we're going to be watching this coming week, how the AU is going to react to this whole problem. Because I don't think both sides are going to benefit if they are going to push these guys out, being landlocked countries. But this is where, you know, economic corridors of moving goods and people, it's very important in developing a country, in establishing corridors. And we have done it very well in the SADC region. The EAC has the leading and best corridor infrastructure in Africa, the EAC, East African Community.
Sure.
And we are doing well in SADC, you know, towards that direction. And unfortunately, ECOWAS did not do the same.
Sure. I've got a friend who's a business person in Botswana, and he's had his container stuck in Durban for the last 3 months. So he's had to reorder his stock from China, and it's coming through Namibia now.
Yeah.
And he says he's going to stick with that plan. because he says, because the port issues in Namibia are not as hectic as they are here currently, with the dysfunction, with the infrastructure that is falling apart.
Despite dysfunction, the red tapes as well.
The red tape as
I
well.
I think Namibia has softened the regulations towards neighboring countries that they have partnered with.
And that's what he's saying, that it's going to start making better business sense for him to just use the Namibian port.
Let me tell you, it may be far, but it makes better business sense. A few years back, when I joined Cross Border, was part of the team that did the corridor research. You know, I actually drove all Southern African corridors.
Yo.
Over 30,000 kilometers.
I was going to say, it's a very long drive.
Yeah. Now, one of the documents we produced at that time, and I'm saying this in my private capacity, not officially, there was to warn the government. Fresh, I'm telling you, this was around 2013, 2014. We're warning the government that Mozambique is developing the port of Beira, which is far up north. And it has the same deep sea levels, whatever, as the port of Durban.
It'll be a natural port, yes.
And you know what did they do, those countries from EAC to, you know, from east to west, you know, coast of the continent? They just created a very good road infrastructure moving from east to west, as well as rail. Now it is cheaper, faster, and safer for people to move their goods on the southern tip to Namibia, to the port of Walvis Bay, and which is on the west coast, and then on the east coast to the port of Beira, because of the challenges we are having in our ports on the south. The government did not act on that 7-8 years back, and it has caught up with us. And I got paid, by the way. I was earning a salary. It was my job. You know, and you write these advisory papers, and people just sit and say, these ones are joking. But it has caught up with us. So now it's the Walvis Bay port and the port of Beira. And this is more on the southern part. If you move upper north, you'll have the port of in Angola. And then you look at what Tanzania and Kenya have done.
Sure.
So it's a challenge for South Africa. But we had an advantage because we occupy both oceans, both sides. We have ports on both sides.
Absolutely.
We didn't take advantage of that.
But is it not frustrating the level at which a lot of our administrators and people governing us and managing the way things work, managing your state-owned enterprises, that we do all these research papers that often say there's a problem here, but they're never taken seriously? President Mbeki was told that there's a problem here. You need to sort out what's happening at Eskom. We're going to have a problem. It's only years later he apologizes that we should have acted. And it's 2020 is, hindsight is 2020. But why asking experts to tell you if there's a problem if you're not going to listen when the experts tell you there's a problem?
It's the question of not, and this is what we spoke about the other day. If political office bearers, presidents and political parties can deploy experts as ministers. Now you are taking Botsang as an expert. He's a diplomat. He's a border management expert or corridors expert. He writes a paper on border management or diplomacy or convention. And he gives it to a minister who has never been to school, who knows nothing about that process. How do you expect that minister to have that understanding? They don't listen to their advisors. Their advisors are sometimes not even experts in the field they are deploying them on. And so it will be better. We are in a year of elections. We are going to go into a new government, absolutely, with new ministers. If you are going to deploy a minister in, for example, human settlement, let it be somebody who knows a little bit about town planning and houses and building, and or have advisors or experts who will listen to technocrats on the ground. But Fresh, if somebody goes and asks me to go and write a paper now about health, I know nothing about health and science, and I'm not a physician. And if one of the ministers takes me to become their advisor and is a minister of health, and that minister is a former school teacher who's also not a health expert, we must expect chaos there. So I think the government should actually try. It's not always possible, but try and deploy people who are experts in the field. Look at when Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi was at health. Look at when Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma was at health. They're both health experts. They're both medical doctors. And things got better. And look at now, Justice Lamola is an advocate or a lawyer by profession. I will not say he's doing an excellent job, but there's a little bit of direction compared to when we had people there who knew nothing about the law.
Mm.
And what's wrong in asking these ministers to go and study? And this is where now the political parties must deploy people who are young and who are educated in those fields. Mm. It will aid the country. You know, I heard when Dr. Kosi and Susputa Ramukhupa came in, and like, he's an engineer, he's going to sort Eskom out. And I went and I sat down, what kind of an engineer? You can't just take any engineer.
Mm.
Is it an engineer in electricity or electrical soft current or heavy current? Or maybe he's a mining engineer, or maybe he's a mechanical engineer.
Mm. Mm.
Does it help the process when those experts at Eskom and at Midupi and Kusile, they are talking to him? Does he understand what they are saying? And I think that is what is important. It will not harm the ANC, the DA, the big parties. They've got educated, equipped, capable young people.
Mm.
And I've said the other day, young, they shouldn't even count me and you. I saw our followers are calling us roadmans on their comments. We are not yet road, but if the government goes and hires somebody who's 45, who's an expert to go and do the job, and I've used Rwanda as an example. The Minister of Communication in Rwanda and spokesperson of government is 32 years old, 33 this year.
Mm.
He's got a master's degree in that field of study.
Yep.
The Minister of Youth and Sports Development is a very young star.
Mm.
So if you go and you remove Mama Dr. Nkosazana Zuma from being Minister of Health and you make her Minister of Arts, Youth and Sports, and really, what are we, youth, what are we trying to do as a nation?
Mm.
And I think the government must use these elections of 2024, moving into the new government, as an opportunity to correct the wrongs of the past.
Don't waste your current crisis, guys.
Yes.
There's a crisis, don't waste it.
And fresh, it's an opportunity because the oldies, the former prisoners, the former exile people, they've eaten. You know, they've eaten.
And
they
aged.
Were taken and aged. And they were taken care of. And they've done well in theirs. Can they move aside?
Mm.
And we have youngsters who can, or young people, young generation, who have young and fresh ideas to can move the country forward.
In fact, I'd like to take back that statement, don't waste the crisis. Because I've never heard a single politician admit there's a crisis. So don't waste this challenge. They love the word challenge, but no one will ever admit there's a crisis.
Coincidentally, I hear during the course of this past week, Minister Lindi Wezulu, you know, I still refer to you as ambassador. I was actually watching, she was interviewed in one of the media TV channels, and she admitted actually quite a number of things.
Mm.
She admitted that while there are successes, there are challenges. You call them challenges. There are challenges here.
No,
and
they
there,
call
here
them
and
challenges.
There. Yeah,
I think there are quite a few crises.
Yeah, no, I think it's beyond challenges. I think it's crisis now.
Yeah.
Once people's taps dry out, once the aircraft are no longer flying, once there's no electricity, you know, in the past year, 2023, we had 332 days of darkness.
Mm.
So in 356 or 55 whatever days of the year, only less than 30 people had electricity the whole day.
Mm.
For me, that is crisis.
Mm.
When the rent water taps dry, there's no water in mid-rent.
Even for a day.
Yeah, for
just
a day.
For a day.
It's you call that crisis. Mm. It was crisis that killed people in Hammanskraal. It's crisis that kids in KwaZulu-Natal, they miss school. On top of young girls having problem with periods and health, they miss school when it's a rainy day. When it starts a storm in the high school, they must go home. Because there's no bridge. It's crisis that children in Limpopo, as well as in the Eastern Cape, they still, you know, die in pit latrines.
Mm.
And when we say such, it does not mean there's no good that government has done. We have talked about the good that government has done. But once it impacts and affects human lives.
Mm.
For example, security. You go to Deep Slot, Olive and Old Boss, downtown city of Joburg.
Mm.
You are unsafe to be there.
You know, the sad thing, Butsang, is we've become so desensitized when it comes to death of citizens.
Yes.
That is why no one will ever admit there's a crisis. In a lot of other countries, one death makes front page news.
Exactly.
You'd think that a whole school bus of children had come off a cliff.
Especially,
but we've become so used to death that it's almost
like
another 20 people are dead. Next week, we want to lose another 30, but we want to keep it moving. because we've normalized that people are dying.
And also violent death. You know, if people die because there's a pandemic that the government couldn't control, sure, like it happened with COVID, it was beyond the government. Mm. The world was caught off guard, you understand? But these are violent deaths that we experienced. These are deaths that could have been avoided. Mm. During the course of this past week, a bus with 53 girls in the Free State went off the road and you know, there were even fatalities there. And it's okay. When we see death in our newspapers, as we say, somebody has been shot and killed. Somebody has been stabbed.
It's just another day.
It's just another day, and we continue life as normal in South Africa. Mm. And I don't know whether we have lost value for life as human beings, as African people, or we are too many that politicians and those who are supposed to be protecting people, they see nothing wrong that, you know, there's a gun. You know, South Africa is part of the AU. We are part of the peacekeeping, you know, missions in Africa. We have been talking as a nation about silencing the guns in Africa. But these guns that we are pushing to be silenced in Africa, they are making noise in the streets of Alexander, the streets of Olivet, the streets of KwaMashu. Guns are going every day. The Cape Flats. It's guns everywhere, and people are dying. And yet, we find, and we also must take responsibility as normal citizens, that we find it normal to say, hey, they killed my brother last week. I was burying a friend of mine, and next week it's another one. Next week it's another one. But these criminals, these thugs as well, they hide within the society. Mm. And that's where we have a responsibility.
We protect them.
We protect them. Mm. We know, it, you know, I always
we know that Busan Gilikinsa.
Yeah.
But also Busan, you know, gives
it's
us...
It's glorified.
But Busan also buys us groceries and looks after the community, you know, so it's okay.
There's two types of thugs. Mm. One is a political thug. Another one is a criminal. They do the same thing.
And we defend both of them.
We vote others into power and we house others. Mm. You know, this one who kills Kinta, he steals vehicles and robs people. You know that when somebody robs vehicles, there's possibility of death.
Sure.
And we still allow that person to live within the community because he buys us booze, he gives us money. So what they do is they starve the people in order to, you know, make them beggars and keep them as prey. Politicians do the same. Mm. They've starved people. They've not made people to be well equipped so that we can challenge them. We can tell them when they do wrong, because they will starve you. Mm. And then they will come and bring you grants and threaten you like the president did to say...
Do you figure people are deliberately being turned into dependents?
I think it's deliberate fresh.
For political gains also.
And to also deal with people who can... You know, when you have conscientized people, the politicians will not be comfortable. If we were a conscientized nation, if our people will stand up and question the government, especially on basics, if people would stand up and go to court, to the public protector's office, and say the municipality of Joburg or Tshwane or Ekurhuleni is denying us clean water as our constitutional right, therefore we are laying a charge against them, you understand? There's another groundbreaking ruling that happened in the past week in the Free State. I don't know what it's Mangaung called. They ruled that the community or residents, what the municipalities failed to deliver, they can stop paying and outsource.
Sure.
So we as a resident, a committee can
we'll
say...
We'll pay for our own rates.
We'll go and hire a company that will fix potholes,
that
will take care of the streets, or that will supply us water. I think that's what people should do.
And until we have functional municipalities, maybe also communities should be allowed to do.
Exactly.
That we will look after ourselves, since you can't look after
ourselves. Exactly. We'll look after ourselves. So these are some of the challenges. Mm. You know, one of the things that happened that irked me in the past week, and I didn't test that information with the South African Reserve Bank. I must put that disclaimer, but I read it in a newspaper that the South African Reserve Bank have declared the Bank of Orania. I think it's Ora LT something, because their currency is Ora. Orania is that dorpy in the Karoo.
The African enclave.
So they've said it's a well-managed financial bank. And I'm like, if the South African Reserve Bank can actually even rate that bank, does it mean they recognize them? And I'm not questioning what the Africaners have done in Orania, because they didn't have confidence in the central government or the provincial government, so they clapped themselves to create a state within a state. And that's not my problem, that's them. But we allowed them. And why? Because now they've got schools, they've got their currency, they've got their flag, their national anthem, and they're living life. It's continuing. And our government is sitting and looking at this whole thing happening in front of our eyes. It's going to happen in Cape Town very soon. There are people who are already cooking up a case that the Western Cape or the city of Cape Town should be independent. And that's why there are calls for the country to go back to the four provinces instead of nine.
Sure.
And you know what are the four provinces? The ones that were created by the British and the Dutch after they conquered us. So these are some of the things we must be wary of as a nation and not allow. Because politicians, I don't know why they don't care. My only concern with political office bearers is why don't they care? Why none of them, except in some instances, Panyaza Lusufi will stand up and say this thing of having the IEB and the Basic Education Department exam, we must try and merge and find a common ground. Why don't we say such things with all other sectors? You know, why don't we say to South African police services, you don't have resources, you are struggling. There are community forums. There are armed members of the community who are trained police, soldiers, and personnel, security personnel. Why don't we know that these committees, but let them work and gel together to an extent that a security officer can arrest and be part of the proceedings in court because they live within the community.
Have a network.
And that's what we need, but we don't have a political will.
No, because nothing is a crisis.
Well, we've got crisis. The country is in crisis.
A young girl was shot in the head by a stray bullet the other day. It was in the news the other day, and now it's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. It's gone. It's gone. She's gone. The issue is gone.
And the value
people
of
people in
life.
Madibe can't drink the water anymore.
Yes.
It's brown.
Yes.
But there is no crisis.
And that's serious crisis. Water, it's like education, it's like health.
It's a basic human right.
It's enshrined in the constitution of the country, yet we as citizens, we are not taking up the government, you know, for that. We allow the government to bring water to us with tankers. Then it's dirty. Then it's not properly purified.
And who's monitoring that the tankers are getting us water that is portable in the first place?
But how did we arrive at this stage when a racist apartheid government led by Peg Buota signed a deal with Lesotho for the Lesotho Highlands Projects, the water project? I mean, the apartheid government could do that and sign the agreement. We didn't upkeep to that. You understand? And we there's water crisis in the world, but we are not taking care of the little we are having in order to can take care of the nation, and all because of collapse of infrastructure. But I always say all because of corruption. Because when you look at what is happening in Rainwater, you know, I learned last week when I went to the funeral of my friend Tebza from Rainwater. I only learned last week that Rainwater is the largest bulk water supply in Africa. In the whole continent, it's the largest. Because I was asking, why would people kill each other? Because now there's a water mafia. You know, I learned it from the Minister of Water Affairs. And all that. Now there's water mafia because the money there is bigger than the construction mafia. You need water for everything.
And it's easy money.
And it's easy money. Now.
And it might not be in the interest of people that actually sell water for our infrastructure to work optimally.
Yes, yes. So you can see the link between the infrastructure building, what you call construction mafia, and the water mafia, and people are dying. And so I think it's a political will where political office bearers must take a stand and say, let's identify what are the five major crises in South Africa. One, it's security. Two, it's health. Three, it's education. Collapse of infrastructure. Those are our crises. For let's put our energies and resources into these challenges. We wouldn't be sitting with 825 doctors who are unemployed. And the government wakes up and say, we don't have money to can hire them. We have vacancies. We need doctors, but we don't have money to hire them. You know, I'm diverting. Coming back to the story of these doctors that cannot be hired. I listened to the deputy or the minister. No, it's not. It's the deputy minister of health.
Patla, yes.
Patla is the minister. I think it's Mkonzi or something, okay, the deputy, saying everything is fine. Those people were taken for training. Process was followed, but there's no money. And I asked myself, when a student leaves matric and go to varsity and register for medicine, and you give that student bursaries, you know what is the output.
You can see the pipeline.
You can see the pipeline. You will know that after 6 or 7 years, you have...
There's a new cohort.
There's a new cohort. And like, what did you do to plan for those students that the state has been funding? Let's live in 5 years. Let's live 5 years fresh. Their last 2 years of study. it is compulsory this country according to the South African Medical Council that they must do a 2 year
in service,
you understand?
Internship training
already 2 years service. Before they finish. You already know that there's 2,000 doctors in inverted commas who are doing their in-service training. Where is planning? Where is budgeting? How much are doctors in the public service earning that the government cannot afford to place 800 of them or even half of them in needy areas of the country? How much does it cost? If we can spend 6.5 million in one night party of Gogos and Madalas having a party, a sauna party, 6.5 million. If we would have divided that 6.5 million with five doctors, would have made a difference. But also, where is the planning in government to say there is an output that's coming our way? We have to have an input basket where we will receive this graduate. It's not there. And then you ask yourself, I will not blame ministers for that. The DGs, the HR executives in the departments, the South African Medical Council themselves, what did they do to aid and guide government to say, there's this influx coming that we are certificating and confirming to be doctors ready to be deployed? We are not doing anything about
and
that.
And we need doctors.
And we need doctors. We need, actually, we need, and it's not only about doctors, nurses, you know, all people in the medical field of study, what people call medical personnel.
Sure.
You understand? We need them in clinics, in townships, in rural areas, but the government has no plan in accommodating those people who can render a constitutionally based service health. Then we have a problem. What I call
but
it a problem.
But it's not a crisis.
It is a crisis. Your ministers, you and your ministers can. It is a crisis
it's a
that
challenge.
We're supposed to be
it's
dealing with. Yeah.
Anyway, just in wrapping, and I suppose in solidarity with the people of Namibia. I remember when I was a child, when Sesere Sekgama passed away.
Yes.
I mean, I was still a child, but you feel the pain as a nation. I remember Deputy President Lingile Tseseretse passing away, felt the pain. I remember Madiba passing away, felt the pain. Sir Kitumile Masira passing away, felt the pain. So I can only imagine the pain Namibians are going through.
At
the death of President Khayenkgolo.
Yes, fresh. Sadly, so we have lost one of the giants. We praised him twice on this show,
and he was a guy.
In
fact, conspiracy theorists figure he's been taken out.
Wow, I haven't come across that, but I thought they said it's cancer, isn't it?
They're saying it's cancer, but a lot of people will tell you that if you know what to put away. A person will get cancer.
Look, we featured him twice on this show. He has been a rebel. He has been taking. He took a stand against the Germans and on the reparations that he called them a joke.
And also when they commented on how many Chinese are there in Namibia.
He took a very good stand. There was a time he actually, you know, dragged in the German ambassador directly to his office, you know, and unfortunately, you know, made the spirit. You know, it's a gallant fighting spirit of he's a former liberation movement fighter, you know, of SWAPO, and he was the first prime minister of the Republic of Namibia after independence from when it was still Southwest Africa. And look, it at an age of 82 plus, he's an elderly person, but he was still strong and going well. It came as a shock to me. I didn't know that he was living with cancer. But to our neighbors, the Namibians, they call themselves the land of the Braves. And it's a loss not only to the Namibians but to the region, you understand? The Trans-Kalahari corridor that is between South Africa, Botswana and Namibia, the SADC region as a whole, Namibia is part of SAKU. So what has happened in Namibia, the loss of the head of state, it's impacting on us as one big family in the southern tip of the continent. Yes.
And he was a good one.
I think he was one of the good leaders that we had in the continent. May his soul rest in peace. I don't like us. We are ending our shows with sad news these days.
And King Charles also has a cancer that they haven't disclosed. They're saying he went for prostate. So I'm wondering, you know, I can imagine the bunch of doctors saying, no, you go. No, you go. No, no, I can't put my finger up the king. No, you go. Because apparently he had an enlarged prostate,
yes,
but they're not disclosing the cancer that he has.
The type of cancer.
And I find it refreshing that King Charles would wear his health on his sleeve like that, because generally we knew nothing about the Queen.
We knew
nothing.
So the royal family, the British royal family, they always kept it secret.
Absolutely.
Closed, you know?
So it's quite a breath of fresh air that King Charles is fine with people knowing that, listen, there's a cancer I'm being treated for. I just want to get back to my duties, whatever those are. But there's a cancer I'm being treated for. And but I'm good.
Well, let's wish the king well. Cancer is a very, very, a bad disease or illness that, you know, I've seen people suffering from it. And yeah. But sadly, you know, the world has been taken by all these diseases. If it's not guns and bombs, it's these diseases.
Mm. Yeah. Botsang, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brother Fresh. Thanks.
Interesting chat as always.
Yep. Thank you. And by the way, the calls for us to have politicians or people after, we are celebrating a year next week, by the way.
Oh, yes, we are.
In 2 weeks' time, but next week, the date, we'll be celebrating a year. We are having a surprise. It will be an extraordinary show for our viewers and guests. And
absolutely.
We are responding to some of their requests, but it will be done completely different. And for now, let's not disclose that because it is a very big surprise for them. We will be having guests and completely different.
Absolutely. And another reason we can't tell you the surprise is because Lebaloi, you're going to steal the idea.
Yes. I'm worried about them stealing the idea.
Where do we find your social media?
As usual, on X, it's at Botsang M, and as well as on, IG. But botsang@gmail.com on email and
sure.
Then +27824859100 on WhatsApp.
Great stuff. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Politrix with Botsang Muilwa. Coming to you from Discover TV, DISCOVR TV. Check them out. They do some very cool stuff. They've got an incredible studio, Discover TV. We're part of the Africa Podcast Network, we look beautiful thanks to the cinematography of Pezulu Works. Shout out to Trevor and his team, Dumelo et al. Our audio imaging, courtesy of artist The Floor Fraser, and our guest and our host, Botsang Muilwa. Creative producer, Kuvesh Mohan, and show producer, Keleso Modisa King. Please email us at waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Till next week, have a great week in spite of yourselves.